Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
To each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Eric Lowen with us. He's the author of The Future of Value, How Sustainability Creates Value Through Competitive Differentiation. He's a globally recognized expert in the fields of competitive strategy, growth, and sustainability. A consultant and frequent speaker, Eric is the author, again, of The Future of Value, a book that connects sustainability with competitive strategy and financial performances. His work is regularly featured at the Harvard Business Review, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, as well as Newswire's industry publications and other media. And let us say, Eric, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, hi. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's work on this word called sustainability. You know, we've heard it bannered around so much. Let's see if we can get a working definition and then start from there and then move forward.
I think you're absolutely right. Sustainability means so much to so many people that it's become almost a difficult to define term. But for me, when I think of sustainability, at least from a business perspective, sustainability is a term of convenience. And what I mean by that is sustainability in and of itself doesn't mean anything, but rather it's used to refer to the environmental and social challenges wrought by and faced by business.
Okay, now when we talk about business and sustainability today, you go back, Eric, 10, 15, 20 years, and based on the economy, the worldview, the world markets, things were quote-unquote sustainable. Growth could be projected, etc. Today, we're looking at an entirely different world with every aspect that affects business is so changeable that stability is a word that seems to be almost out of reach for most people. How do you maintain that sustainability and growth in this kind of a marketplace that we're in today?
Well, it's a great question, and that's the topic of my book, The Future of Value. It's a how-to book that really helps both individuals and companies, small and large alike, to both save and make money by being environmentally and socially friendly. Very quickly, we live outside of Boston. We've got a 2,400-square-foot home. Our utility bill every month has been about $400. Mm-hmm. And just by turning off our computer at night, by turning off the lights during the day when we're not in the house, we've been able to shave about $45 a month just off our utility bills. And that's for just an individual residence. Comes out to about a little over $500 a year in cost savings. Now, if you're a big company or even a smaller company, you do the same thing. You can multiply those savings almost exponentially.
Okay, and I really believe in today's world, you have to look within to start your sustainability, quote unquote, because it's a very competitive marketplace out there, and most people are in business today, especially Eric, they're saying, well, we got to go out and sell this, and we got to compete with this one, and we got to do that. But just as you said, if you start from within, the money that you don't have to spend is equal to I don't know how many times that which you would have to go out and produce just to get that kind of savings that you're talking about. So in essence, it's starting inside and working your way out. That's what I'm hearing you say.
That's exactly right. Many times companies, again, small and large alike, have employees that may not be senior employees. They could be junior employees or mid-level employees who are both personally and professionally passionate about environmental and social causes. And quite often, the best ideas that I've seen companies take to heart and be able to save money by reducing energy, by reducing water consumption, waste sent to landfill, have come not from outside consultants, but from inside, from the employees who know the business best.
But how do we know today, and I really believe this last venture that the government had, and I'm not getting political, just the example itself, when we put X amount of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into a particular car that's going to be electronic, but yet it's not going to be built here. It's going to be built somewhere else, and there'll be jobs somewhere else, yada, yada. So we're saying the environment, we have to be conscious with it. And then the way it turns out is that the car is only going to go 35 miles on electrical, and then the gas jumps in right after that, and by the time you're done, you're only going to get 19 miles to the gallon. And the reason I'm saying this is not so much that particular case, but when we hear environmental, when we hear waste, when we hear so many of these things today, it's so confusing, Eric, as to what's real. What are we really looking at, and where do we get our information from so that we can really get a handle on what it's going to take to be able to, quote-unquote, sustain the business?
I think that's exactly right. And fortunately for the people in the field of sustainability and just business more general, there are these emerging standards that are now starting to come out via the United Nations, via something called the GRI, the Global Reporting Initiative, that essentially helps companies figure out what's fact when it comes to environmental and social challenges and what's fiction. And at the end of the day, businesses and individuals alike are going to be better off when we reach those standards and measure that help us say objectively, you know what, I really do see the impact of climate change because of these three metrics that the United Nations has sanctioned as the right metrics that are scientifically proven and viable, and we see my next door neighbors understanding this, we see business understanding this. One other piece to it is that where I think businesses tend to get in trouble is when we try to overcomplicate things, when we try to come up with these fancy metrics as a way to make ourselves look different from any other companies. And I'm a big believer in just getting to the basics. Just tell us how much energy you used per widget of whatever you produced, and let me compare that against your competitor to see which one is doing a better job.
Now, actually, what I really truly believe is guys like yourself are imperative today, because most businesses, they're doing the business of business. They know their field, they know their craft, but you have to step outside and see what you don't see. You have to go for that blind spot, that those answers to problems, those solutions to problems that were there in front of you but that you didn't see, and it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. Sometimes, and I would say more than often than not, in today's world especially, it takes somebody like yourself to walk in and see what the business owner doesn't see.
And I certainly appreciate that. I've had the opportunity, and I share it in the book, to talk to almost 150 sustainability, strategy, finance, and just regular people, employees of different companies, large and small, to start to get an understanding for, as you said, where are these blind spots where people just take, our companies take energy usage or water consumption for granted. And I come in and I'm able to say, well, you know what, you may have been taking your utility bill for granted, but let's take a look at those utility bills over the last 6-8 months, and let's actually cast a keen eye at exactly what's going on. And more often than not, we're able to discover opportunities to save costs by turning off lights, turning off computers and whatnot.
Okay, let's talk about, we got a couple, 3 minutes to go, and I want to make sure we get this. Let's talk about the model that you've developed, the CLEAR model. 5 steps. First step is what?
The first step is craft your sustainability strategy. Now, that might sound jargony, but what it really means in just very basic terms is just figure out what it is you're trying to achieve from an environmental and social perspective. Are you trying to reduce energy, reduce waste, invest in your local community? That's what I mean by the C in the CLEAR model is craft your sustainability strategy. The last four letters in the CLEAR model, and again, it's C-L-E-A-R, like a clear piece of glass. L stands for leadership, and that comes in the form of having a strong CEO and a strong board of directors who will hold the company responsible for environmental and social challenges and efforts. E is for executing your plan. A is for analyzing the results of your sustainability plan. And then perhaps the most important letter in the CLEAR model is the R, which stands for renewal, because nobody gets sustainability right the first, fifth, eighth, or tenth time. The important thing is to continue to improve, continue to be honest with yourself, your customers, and your stakeholders, and over time we'll get to a point where businesses can get environmental and social goodness right.
By the way, the CLEAR model, is it universal? And when I say universal, are these five overarching steps that it doesn't matter where you are in the world, these steps are going to work. This is what you have to do, and geographic location has nothing to do with it.
That's exactly right. My book goes through and very easy to follow, with highlighted with stories of different companies, many of which we've heard of, many of which we haven't, these five easy to use overarching steps that are equally applicable to small and large companies alike, domestic and global. And in fact, one thing I have that may be of use to your listeners is on my website, ericlowitt.com, I actually have a couple of free tools that will enable any of your listeners to benchmark their company's clear model sustainability efforts versus any of the global Fortune 500 companies in the world. So that way, for free, you can see how you're doing and get great advice in the process.
But is this also part and parcel of a value proposition? And obviously, each company in and of itself has to have that something special about themselves that the competition doesn't have. Is that included in this?
Absolutely is. Very quick example. A family-owned company in New Hampshire called Monadnock Paper Mills. They make these paper hang tags that you can see on the back of clothes when you go to the Gap or other types of clothing stores. 3 years ago, they differentiated themselves from their paper mill peers by really embracing sustainability, and more specifically by putting in place a computer system to help them track all these utility bills and all these water consumption and waste onto landfill consumption. Long story short, that environmental management system, that computer system that helps Monadnock paper mills figure out how they're doing environmentally, was attractive to Gap when Gap was in fact looking for a new vendor to provide sustainably sourced hang tags for all of their clothes throughout their retail footprint. Monadnock Paper Mill was the only paper mill that was able to deliver that sustainably sourced paper. As a result, family-owned, privately held company just made a significant amount of money by being environmentally and socially friendly, by differentiating through sustainability.
You know, I think the most businesses and most CEOs, CFOs today, if you walked into a business and you say, why are you different, you know, in 10 words or less, most of them would have a hard time doing that. And I think in today's world, especially, Eric, in today's world, they've got to know what that is. They've got to be able to say, this is where I'm different. This is where I stand out from the crowd. And this is why to do business with me than, you know, the guy next door. And this is just as critical as, I take it back. Let me say it a different way. This is part and parcel of sustainability in business.
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, I'd go a step further and say it's also part and parcel not only with sustainability in business, but also some of our personal aspect of our lives as well. These are tough economic times. We're all looking to save money. We're all looking to reduce our expenses to ride out this economic storm. Being environmentally and socially conscious, aware of your utility bills, water usage, waste that you're sending out, size of packaging of different products you buy, all of these types of things that we take for granted, if we become more aware of them, we can in turn take action that will save us money both personally and professionally.
I would bet any amount of money that if you and I did a survey and we walked from business to business, And we gave them that list, and we said, how much of this are you doing? You'd probably find 95% of it would look at you dumbfounded. And I think that's why it has to be brought to the table and taken a look at today.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the way to get business to really go beyond that deer in headlights look is to be able to make the case that we're making here tonight that sustainability isn't about altruism. It's not about doing less bad. Sustainability is about improving your bottom line, and there are very straightforward, easy ways companies, small and large alike, can do that, which is what my book talks all about. It provides simple how-to steps for all companies, large and small, to be able to make a financial impact by pursuing sustainability.
Oh, there you go. And then we use the P word also, pragmatism. It infiltrates the whole thing. Eric, we're about out of time. Again, please, your website, we can find you at.
Absolutely. It's www.ericlowitt, that's ericlowitt, two T's like Thomas, all one word, .com. Again, ericlowitt.com.
Wonderful. Eric Lowitt, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, I enjoyed this. Thank you so much for the time.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Pleasant as home is, it isn't what wrong is, so why stay there when
there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Sienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Joe Lamoille is with us. He is the Smarter Dating Guys, one of America's leading dating and relationship experts. 30 days from walking down the aisle with Mrs. Wrong, Dr. Lamoille turned his life around with his Mess to Success 5-Step Dating System and found his current wife in 90 days. He's the author of The ABCs of Smarter Dating, 26 Tips and Strategies to Immediately Improve Your Love Life. And let's say, Joe, I welcome to the show.
Welcome, Michael. And, you know, it's great to be here. I'm so grateful for you allowing me to be here tonight.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Dating is not the same thing as dating was 50 years ago. You used to be, you'd walk up to somebody and you'd say, you come here often, what's your sign? That's all you needed and everything was fine. It doesn't work that way today, does it?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a little different world. Unfortunately, I wasn't alive back then, so I didn't know how good you guys had it.
It was a different world. Before we really get into this, let me give you a great story. There was a place in Los Angeles. I was brought up in L.A. on La Cienega Boulevard. It is probably not there anymore. The name of the place was called The Direct Line. And what you had were tables, and each table had a telephone on it, and it had a number that was up in the air. So let's say you and I, you know, we took off, we went into this place, and there's a couple of women sitting over at table number 7. You'd pick up the phone, and you say, hey, I'm over on table number 6. You want to dance. And it was great because if you got turned down, you didn't have to look like a fool when she said no to you.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but that was the old days.
Very
interesting. What are we doing now? Yeah, what do we do now? What are the major rules? What is it that can be the magic for somebody who wants to get out there in the dating scene?
Well, I think the first thing to start off is to realize that you have the power. You know, a lot of times we believe that we're at the victim of the dating and relationship gods, and they favor some over others. And so the first step is just to get clear and realize that, you know what, you have the power. You can create the results, but you need to understand how the game works. You need to understand the rules of the game.
Okay, but when we talk rules of the game, what are we looking at with rules? That's the key. Here I am, that much old. I'd tell you, but then you'd tell everybody else. I'm that much old, and I'm single, and I want to go out. And now there's rules, and I'm stuck, and I don't know what to do.
Right. Well, I think the first thing is getting clear on what the end destination is. Start with the end in mind. What are you trying to create? You know, are you looking for a serious relationship? Or are you just looking to meet a couple of guys to date? Do you ultimately want to meet someone and get married? Because all three of those will cause you to go and find different kinds of guys. So you really have to get clear on what you're trying to create first. Once you get clear on what you're trying to create, then you got to figure out what's going to take you from point A to point B. And that's where a lot of smarter dating comes in. Because, to be honest, there are so many good guys and good women out there who are both frustrated. You know, I say the circus is the same, the clowns are different.
Sure.
And so it's really learning and understanding how to find that person that you're looking for and being able to screen the wrong ones quickly.
Okay, now, there are five types of women that we guys will not commit to. Now, what are we talking? What kind of women are going to push us away?
Right. Well, here's the thing is because we're under this premise that, you know, women just want a relationship and they're looking for a guy. And there's reasons why a lot of guys don't want to be in relationships. And so what I found is there are five types of women that will immediately push a guy away and make him run from a relationship. So the first one is the victim. And that's the one who's blaming everybody and everything for why her love life is horrible. So she's going to take that out on the guy she's with. And so nothing is a bigger red flag to a guy than being with a woman who's living in her past and saying how horrible things are and how horrible men are. The second is the gold digger, and that's the one who's simply interested in how much money a guy makes, what kind of car he drives, and what his job status is. So guys obviously aren't into that. They're the equivalent of men who are only looking for sex. You know, it's, again, it's the same for both parties. The third is, you know, what I call the slut. That's the woman who's going to give it up to anyone and everyone. She's thinking that because she sleeps with a guy, that the guy's going to like her or want to be in a relationship, which is a big, big mistake. The fourth is what we call the drama queen. And this is the one in talking to single men that they really abhor the most. It's the one where everything is full of drama. You know, as men, we're very simple creatures. You know, when I met my wife, I had one rule. It was don't aggravate me.
Yeah, I'm with you. My kind of guy.
And so, you know, if women understand is that we're just different creatures, we don't do the emotion and the drama, you know, we're the problem solvers. If you come to us with a problem, let us know and we'll go and help you try and fix it. But if you're going to come in all full of drama, we're just going to run away because we just don't operate like that.
Damn, so
and
true.
The last one is the leash. That's the jealous, insecure woman. She's the one trying to keep a guy on a leash, watching his every move because she's insecure. And unfortunately, you mentioned that I was 30 days away from getting married. That's who I was engaged to.
Now, let me ask you this. Because I haven't really been out there for quite a while, okay? And I'm going to probably get out there pretty soon. So here's the question. What's left?
What's left is a bunch of frustrated single people.
When you really come down to it, when you got the victim, the gold digger, the slut, the drama queen, the leash, what's left?
Yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, there are lots of good ones. I use the analogy, it's a lot like going to the mall at Christmas time. You know, it may be crazy, everybody may be harried and stressed out, and it may take you a while, but if you focus on how difficult it is, it's going to be a horrible experience. But if you understand that, hey, you know what? I only need one spot. And so what do I got to do to learn how to get that spot quickly? Like when I go to the mall now during the holidays, I simply go up to the front entrance. I wait for somebody to come out, and I go, excuse me, are you going out? And they say, yeah, I'm going down aisle 3. I've got a blue Toyota. And I simply go park my car, wait there, and usually within 5 minutes, I always get a spot.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's
makes
good.
Sense, right?
I got it, yeah. Yeah, that, no question about it. Now, by the way, the in going out with someone, you know, you're not going to know in 3 seconds which category they fall into. So you go out with somebody, you're out in the middle of the dating process, and then it's got to begin in that first hour or so, doesn't it?
Actually, it should begin before the first hour. You should start the screening process before you even meet. You know, one of the benefits of dating today is there's this thing called online dating. And if you know how to do it right, you could start screening someone from the second you read their profile. And so if you are clear, and that's what I talked about earlier about starting with the end in mind, if you're clear on who exactly that person is that you're looking for, you're going to start looking for the signs, and you're going to start seeing red flags and green flags right away.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with online dating, you see somebody who's absolutely gorgeous, and then they send you a picture, and then they say, oh, the picture you saw was 45 years ago.
It's almost, absolutely.
Well, yeah, how do you get them to tell the truth? And I think another problem, and I've seen this time and again with most people, Joe, you meet somebody that you like. You really like this person, so you're not going to be who you are. You're going to be who you think they want you to be. And then all of a sudden you got this great thing going, and 6 months later, you go back to who you are because you're comfortable, and they don't even know you.
Right. Here's the thing. I agree with that, but there's what I call yes and. Because people are who they are. And yes, absolutely, people will be on their best behavior, and they'll give you what they think you want to hear. But if you really have your eyes open and you really know how to read and screen them, you're going to pick up the red flags. Because, you know, I'll give you a perfect example. One of the women that I worked with, she dated a guy, and this guy pretended to be everything to her in the beginning. But this guy was lying to his boss. He was lying to his friends. He was lying to everybody. Well, guess what he started doing 3 months into her relationship? Started lying to her. So, you know, one of the things is people are who they are in all aspects of their life. Nobody's that good an actor, trust me.
I'm sure. Really, when it comes down to it, they're not. And I think people today are frightened to death of telling the truth. You know, if I tell the truth, what is she going to think of me? If I do this, what is she going to think of me? And vice versa, it happens the same way.
Absolutely. And that's one of the ironies of all this, is because everybody says they want the truth, but very few are able to actually walk in that truth from the very beginning.
You know, well, Joe, where do you think this comes from? When I say where do you think this comes from, it seems like it's a standard kind of a thing that no matter who you are, where you are, they don't tell the truth.
It's no different than someone saying, hey, you know, I'm having a party on Tuesday, you know, I want you to come. And you go, yeah, absolutely, I'll be there. And you know darn well that you're not going to be there. You're just afraid to tell the person the truth. And what I found, you know, to answer your question, it also comes down to self-worth and self-esteem. It's really knowing who you are and believing in yourself and having the ability to communicate in an effective way.
You know, okay, so I pick up the ABCs of Smarter Dating, the 26 tips and the strategies to immediately improve your love life. So really, I come prepared before I even go out with somebody. I can see it, I can feel it, I can understand it ahead of time.
Absolutely. That's the premise.
What would it be like if you went out with somebody the first time and you took one of these things out and you say, page 34, you're out of here, kid. But realistically, that's got to happen.
Yeah. You know, there's one of the things, when you are so clear, and that's one of the reasons why I was able to find my wife so quickly. I was so clear on what I was looking for and what I needed that the second I saw a red flag or the second I saw that someone wasn't going to give me what I needed, I was like the roadrunner, beep, beep, and I was out of there.
Now, by the way, you said you're getting married soon, right?
No, I've actually been married 10 years.
Oh, you did marry.
Sorry.
You did, okay.
I'll have my 10-year anniversary in November 9th.
Oh, well, happy anniversary to you. What was it about her that allowed her to cut through all of this stuff and get to see the true her for you?
Well, it was really not so much her getting through as me really seeing who she was. You know, from the very get-go, you know, we actually met online. So, you know, when I read her profile for the first time, I went, this seems like the kind of girl that I'm looking for. Then we started emailing back and forth, and our dialogue, we had some things in common. The way she responded showed me that she was a respectful person, that we shared some of the same values. We both come from, you know, close-knit Italian families, so we found some common ground on that we were talking about. We shared some values in the way we looked at the world and our family and friends, so we just found some common ground. But, you know, one of the things that helps is to understand that there's a difference between dating someone and being in a relationship. So my mindset at that point, after what I had just gone through, was, you know what, I'm not jumping into another relationship until I'm sure that this is the kind of person I want to be in a relationship with.
Okay, let's go back to the women who who innately have those problems. Dating mistakes that most all women make. What are we talking about? What do we recognize? What do we look for?
Right. Well, I think the biggest thing that I recognize is women giving their power away. It's the guy is responsible for everything. So if he's going to like, it's the ball's in his court whether he's going to like her or not. And so, like you talked earlier, she's going to say and she's going to do things. And when he doesn't call, she's going to chase him around. And so one of the things, and my biggest premise is to, you know, reclaim your power in the dating game, is to really get clear and understand that you have the right to decide. You get the right to choose. And it's like clothes shopping. If it doesn't fit, you just get rid of it. Do not waste your time.
Well, makes sense. Makes total and absolute sense. But when Radio Susie's going over there going, yep, absolutely, that's it. And I like that. Don't waste your time. Get rid of them fast. Yeah. It's funny. Okay. So when we really come down to it, that we're human beings. And as human beings, we have certain frailties. And those frailties happen to be behaviors. And those behaviors are very spottable. And if you can spot what they are, better looking at it ahead of time and anticipate what you're going to get, then go through it and get into trouble.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of like this, Mike. It's like, think if you were a Fortune 500 company and you were going to hire your senior vice president. Are you just going to take his resume and give him the job?
No.
You're going to take his resume. You're going to screen him. You're going to do background checks on him. You're going to bring him in for a couple of interviews. And then you're going to put him on a probation period to make sure that it's a good fit, not only for you, but for him. See, dating should work the same way. The problem, as you alluded to earlier, is we're these emotional creatures, and we allowed our emotions to get in the way. And as a result, we rationalize and justify why we should hire the guy before we've even really gotten to know him.
Sure. Oh, no, there's absolutely no question about that. Joe, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. I pick this book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael Ray, the single guy, what do I get out of this book? Or better yet, women too. But what do I get out of this book that I did not have before I read it?
I think the biggest thing you're going to get is to realize that you've got to be crystal clear on what you're looking for. I mean, I'm talking about as clear as you could possibly be, to really taking a pen to paper and really identifying and answering this one question. If I'm going to spend the rest of my life with someone, what is it that I need to be happy and fulfilled? And once you identify those things, and usually it's around 5 to 7, I've found in my experience. Once you identify those 5 to 7 things, do not go into a relationship with anyone who does not have all 7 of those qualities.
No, and it makes total sense. Joe, let me ask you, do you have a website we can find you at, get the book, get more information?
Absolutely. The website is www.smarterdatingforwomen.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it. And I think people out there got some good ideas tonight.
Great. Thanks a lot, Michael. I appreciate it. Have a great night.
Take care. Good night.
That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore.
will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. As I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back, Susan Marshall, president of Executive Advisor LLC, author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. Susan, hi, welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray.
I've got to move my coffee over here. So it's been, we've been waiting for you to come back to get in this. Wait, this piece of paper is...
Oh, you know what? And put me back on hold, because I really liked that song that was going on. I was really grooving.
Wait, wait, I'm getting distracted.
What is going on in this world?
Yes. Distraction destroys confidence.
Yes. And because we've talked week after week after week that the three elements of backbone are competence, confidence, and risk-taking. And one of the things we're working on developing are confidence clinics, because all of the business reports you read, pick up any political statements, look at people everywhere in every country, confidence is probably at the lowest point that you and I have seen in our lifetimes.
Sure, you bet.
And so we're studying a lot. We're really trying to pinpoint some very concrete things to help people understand why their confidence erodes in certain situations and not others. And more important than that, what they can do to help rebuild it. And it's been fascinating since we talked last week about, journaling. And actually, a guy called me and said, tell me why I'm keeping a journal, because he was doing it. And I said, well, because you're recording your life. And if you're not capturing what's happening in your life, you're missing it. And he started to laugh and he goes, oh, yeah, good. That's all I wanted to know. So it was funny. But the whole notion of distraction is really a huge factor in eroding people's confidence. And you see it every day. We actually have gotten to a point, certainly in business, where we celebrate multitasking, right? If I can do two or three or four different things at a time, woo, I reign, I'm powerful, I can do all kinds of stuff. And yet studies have shown that multitasking in itself is a myth. We're simply changing our focus and literally making many decisions every couple of nanoseconds on what to be paying attention to. And the energy that takes is just extraordinary. And so when you think...
I said no question.
Yeah, when you think in terms of managing distraction, it's the same thing going on. We're constantly making decisions about what to pay attention to and what not. And it really struck home. I'm working with a global architecture firm. We're launching a new leadership program next month in Chicago. And the woman that I'm working with is based in Washington, D.C., and she's managing not only this program that we're creating, but several others. Every conversation we have, and we're on the phone for 3 and 4 hours in conference calls, her BlackBerry's constantly chirping. She starts saying a sentence, we're looking at, slide presentation or whatever. She starts saying a sentence, stops 3 or 4 words into it to look at an email that just came in, to find a text that she thought she had sent. It's just remarkable to listen to her dialogue, or attempted dialogue, I guess, more accurately. She's a mess.
Let me ask you a question. I think it's important. Is distraction, can that become habit? And when
Absolutely.
I say habit, yeah, okay, that's where I want to go with that. I'm listening
Absolutely.
And thinking.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
But you know, here, people get real angry when you try to put it in those terms. When you know, everybody's sick of hearing the word choice. We all have choices. We all make choices. Well, people now, because there's so much going on and because there's such a feeling that if you don't at least sort of sideways glance on everything that's going on around you, you're going to miss something important. We used to say, you know, 100 years ago when you and I were kids, right, you have to be ready because you never know when your ship might come in. Your big opportunity might show up. That right person might walk into a room, and if you're not paying attention, you're going to miss that particular thing. Well, amp that up times 100, and it's how people are feeling today. If they're not seeing, not everything because it's impossible, but most everything that's going around on around them, somehow they're going to miss an opportunity. And so we say, well, yeah, but you know what? You're not really seeing those things. And they're all becoming this blur and this pace of life and this pace of, you know, work that's making you feel not only overwhelmed but deficient because you never finish anything. Or if you do, it takes three times longer because you've started and stopped 16 times. And so the discipline of realizing that, you know, we can't pay that many attention to that many things, and ordering our days according to some plan. You know what I think it boils down to? I don't think people know what they want is part A, and part B, even if they did, they're reluctant to say it.
Well, let me throw something out at this point, because I'm listening very closely to what you're saying. And also, you can hide behind distraction. Mm-hmm. You can hide behind the ability to be successful. You can hide behind the ability to be accountable and responsible for the outcome of what you're working on, too. So that's something we also have to take a look at.
Well, and that creates real heartburn for managers. You know, we talk about young talent. We talk about talented people who come in with lots of energies and lots of ideas. And actually, I was working with the board last week because they've got a situation where there's really bad behavior going on. And nobody's quite sure how to call this person on it. Nobody really knows what the fallout is going to be. So guess what? Everybody just stays really, really busy.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to become a problem that they'll wish they had dealt with. And so again, yes, hiding behind using distraction to avoid doing things you'd rather not do, or you're not really sure how to do, is really another big factor here. So we're using distraction to, avoid responsibility or accountability. And you know yourself, and you see it happen to people. Every time we do that, we feel bad. We feel not right. Well, listen to me. I'm just sitting here thinking, you know what? That's such an old-fashioned notion. I think we're beginning to feel less bad, frankly.
Yeah.
And we're being sort of caught up in the vortex of technology and change and all kinds of things, and offloading any bad feeling to somebody else.
Well, we did this, I don't know how many weeks, months ago. That's called a blame. Point the finger at somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. And it's becoming a cultural, it's culturally accepted to be doing that. And I really believe that, you know, going back to the confidence clinics and trying to get at, you know, the behaviors and the activities that either support confidence or you know, sort of chop at it, nick at it, and this whole notion of distraction really boils down to choice. And yet we don't like to blame victims, right, because they made the bad choice. Oh, my goodness, the student loan thing today, right? Don't worry if you can't pay your student loans. We'll handle that for you. No. So we're moving away from taking responsibility and having the discipline to pay attention to only those things that matter to the work you're doing and not worrying about all the rest. And Seth and I had about a two-minute conversation before he patched me through to the show. He's working on this new technology. He's really jazzed about it, and he's talking about, you know, it's contact management, it's website stuff, and he was talking really, really fast.
Yeah.
And it fascinates me, and I think, you know what, he's jazzed about what he does. I have not a clue what he's talking about. And in certain situations, I will admit that would make me feel uncomfortable because I should know something about something that he's saying. I don't. let it go. I don't need to pay any attention to it.
So what?
Yeah.
So what?
Well, I might miss something.
Yeah, sure. And when it really comes down to it, we're so worried about having to know everything because somebody's going to think something if we don't know. It's totally garbage. It's like you have a tremendous expertise in your area. And if I talk about something that you don't know, you haven't been exposed to before, then why is it, and this isn't you personally, this is hypothetically.
Right.
Why
right.
is it that you feel less about yourself because you don't know what my expertise is? How can you know? How can anybody know everything?
And the lost opportunity in that is we lose the opportunity to, instead of saying, gosh, I feel deficient because I don't know, turn that around and say, gosh, I'm so curious about, tell me what you know, tell me what you do. So not only do you get to talk about your area of expertise, I get to learn something, further the relationship. And we both end up feeling good and we both end up a little bit smarter.
Sure.
We've got to just turn this whole thing 180 degrees and say, what am I curious about? Well, it goes back to the fundamental question, what do I want? What do I want to accomplish? What do I want to become? What do I want to learn about? What do I want to contribute? Now, given that set of stuff, what do I need to learn? And what matters not one iota? And all that stuff that doesn't matter, now we can put in the palm of our hand, go, blow it away and say, bye-bye.
Yeah, gone.
Just free. Yeah, free ourselves from all of that. But inherent in that, and it's one of the other things I've been thinking about, is we're almost at a point where we have to force people to take a break, to turn off their stuff, to tune out everything that's going around them and just rest. Because a mind that is so frazzled, as so many are today, is not effective. I don't believe we're going to find solutions to our biggest problems unless we can relearn how to discipline our minds to think about things that we want them thinking about, to shut out the noise, you know, the whole flow thing, right? We can't get the flow when we're constantly redeciding what we're thinking about.
No, I got loud and clear, and there's so many thoughts today, so many things going on, especially with, quote-unquote, the technology. And I think that in and of itself is causing a problem because we are getting so technically motivated, and every part of our life has got to do with something like that. We're beginning to lose that human touch, that human interrelationship back and forth. It's all text, and it's all this, it's all that. And if we're not careful, we're all going to become robots.
Well, I think that's true, and yet I'm beginning to see a backlash. I'm beginning to see even young people say, you know what, I don't really have to post what I had for lunch on Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't really need to go to Facebook 14 times a day because there's nothing really there that matters. And frankly, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I can't keep up with it all. So you know, the pendulum swings. We're beginning to see that. But I do think that technology is going to continue to challenge us in ways that we're not really even thinking about.
Yeah, but the biggest challenge is challenging yourself. And I think that's what happens constantly, daily, in businesses, et cetera. We challenge ourselves because we've got to keep up because of what somebody else might think. And we've got to get to that point where you don't care what somebody else thinks. You do the best job you can possibly do. You produce, you get behind it, you support people, you do collaborative effort. And if somebody doesn't like you and if somebody doesn't think you're doing the job well enough, guess what? They're going to think that no matter what you do. So
that's
it's called
exactly right.
Let it go and move forward.
And in fact, what you've just said really describes the essence of the confidence clinics. To help people recognize the gifts and the talents that they've been given that are unique and special to them, that are worthy of developing, and that will allow them to do things that they feel proud of, that they're excited about. And the more you can sort of simmer in those feelings that you're making a contribution or you're learning something that's meaningful to you and to others you care about, the less time you have for distraction. The less concern you have with what somebody else is thinking about you or might, you know, opinion they might have of you, because you're so involved in doing work that is really satisfying and that matters. And that you're learning from. You know, I was at a conference last week on education, and all of the yammering about, oh, we've got to have this new reading program, blah, blah, blah. No, you know what? We're distracted by the technologies, the tools, the programs. We have lost the essence of our jobs as educators.
Let me add something to that. And I've heard it time and again now. We're also finding that nationally there are jobs out there to be had, but they're not finding the people that have the qualifications to do the job, which means the educational system is falling down. So they're saying, educate, put more money into it. No, give the kids the value for staying in school. Detroit, 55% plus of dropouts, and across the nation, you got 35-40% of the kids do not stay in school. And it's not because more education. It is not because of the dollars we dump into it. Where is the value for staying there? When the value for not staying there beats the value for a senior two, the value for leaving, then you stay there. That's really what it is. What's going to get me the most emotional satisfaction? Yeah. What am I going to feel best about? And most of the time, it's not staying there.
And because there, yes, and there have been things created outside of the education system that are drawing kids away from it, that are giving them a sense of confidence. And gangs is the classic, right? Kids join gangs because they feel a member. They feel some confidence in these people they're hanging around with. Whether they're up to no good or not really is immaterial. They belong to something that's bigger and more powerful than they are that accepts them. And so, the whole notion of confidence can get very, very slippery sometimes. And that's why I think we've got to stay focused on what are the things that we can point to that are either supporting confidence or eroding it.
Back off for one reason and one reason only. They back off because they're not accepted. You alluded to it with the gangs.
Yep.
If not accepted, you're not, quote, unquote, part of the family. So you're going to have a family at work, you're going to have a family at home, and if you don't have it there, you're going to go find it someplace else. That's where the problems start. Now, we've got a couple of minutes to go, and I think one of the greatest lessons anybody can learn would be to say what?
In the context of distractions.
You want the answer to that?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah, that's right here. Yeah, learn to say no. Yes. What are my priorities? The other thing that I like to encourage people to do is, you know, go back to the list making. If you know what you want to accomplish by the end of the week, here it is again, that big 6-foot if. Make a list of stuff day to day that you want, you know, you can get done, or that will keep you focused on getting things done, so that by the end of the week you don't turn around and go, man, I'm exhausted. I've been running, you know, Mach 2 with my hair on fire all week. I don't even know what I've done. So make the list of stuff that you want to do. And yes, when people say, can you help me with, or, you know, your device chimes with an instant message or a text, say no, not now. Discipline yourself to look at your email X number of times a day on a schedule that you determine, not somebody else. Make time to make your phone calls. I mean, structure your time.
Yeah.
No is okay. No is important, and what I think you and I have talked about this before. If you cannot say no, you never say yes.
Yeah. No, I got you loud and clear. Loud and clear. Okay, we're about ready to run out of time here, and I hate to say no to you, but we're just about done. Website.
No, for now. Discipline.
Yeah, for now. No, for now. Website we can find you at. Buy the book.
Www.
Get all the information.
That.
Get confident.
Yep. executiveadvisorllc.com. The book is there. The book is also available at amazon.com. And by the way, the book is loaded with very practical things you can do to gain power and influence, not only at work, but over your life.
Wonderful. We're going to sit right here until we see you again next week.
Don't be distracted, okay?
Okay, good night.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Good night.
You may even miss me, baby. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. running. You always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. For you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mayer's back with us. Dr. Mayer Eisenstein is the author of Don't Vaccinate Before You Educate, CEO of Home First Natural Pharmaceuticals Medical Watch segment. That's today. That's tonight. Mayer, welcome back.
Oh, welcome, Michael Ray. You know, I was thinking that this is the last week of what they call Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Yeah.
And I really don't like that definition. It's like, what do you mean awareness? You want to do something to help something. You know, you could be aware of a problem and do nothing. That's what seems to be going on with the whole treatment of cancer and breast cancer. So I like to rather call it Breast Health Month.
Yeah.
So, and what are some of the natural things, many of them we've talked about for the last quite a few years now, that can help. But I'm going to add one to it. Well, of course, we talked about vitamin D, and I'll bring some of the studies that show that the higher your vitamin D level is, the lower your probability of developing cancer. And if you have cancer, it's more than just breast cancer. It's all types of cancers. It's going to increase your survival rate also with higher levels of vitamin D. Omega-3 fatty acids, you know, and the problem we have with omega-3 fatty acids, they're found in very healthy fish, like salmon, the fatty fish. But the trouble is they're so full of toxins like mercury that we can't eat them anymore. And the third thing that we've talked about is bioidentical progesterone cream. And this is a readily available. It's not by prescription, you know. And there is quite a few studies, and one of the major studies was done by a Dr. Moore a few years ago, and it was actually 1976. It's how long it is. He showed that adequate levels of progesterone at the time of breast cancer surgery, the people who had adequate level had a 62% survival rate after 18 years, and the people who had low progesterone, they had a survival rate of less than 30%. And now I'm going to add a fourth thing, and that is we know that obesity goes along with increased cancer rates, all type of cancer, especially breast cancer. And now we find that HCG, the pre-hormone that I've been using, and many doctors around the country to help people, including myself, lose weight, actually will be a treatment for the lowering the probability of breast cancer and for possible even increasing survival rates. There we have it.
Now when you're doing the HCG diet, okay, isn't there a certain amount of calories that you're limited to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is that you're not going to lose weight. I mean, it's a relatively simple formula. Calories in, calories out. That everyone agrees with, which means if you're taking in more calories than you're expending, you're going to gain weight. If you expend more than you take in, you're going to lose weight. You know, and you do the, if you're balanced, you're not going to gain, you're not going to lose. And it used to be historically people would grow in size until they were about 18 or 19 years old and stay the same size until they died, you know. But in the last 75 years, and especially the last 25 years, people seem to keep growing as adults and substantially growing, you know. And there are a lot of theories as to why this happens, you know. But the bottom line is we have to be able to find a means of shrinking our intake without losing muscle, and then we'll be able to and keep our output going. And the problem is all the calorie-restricted programs, and it doesn't make a difference which one it is, the amount of muscle that you break down runs between 25 and 40%. And the problem with this is the muscle in your body is what causes you to expend calories. Every pound of muscle burns about 30 to 40 calories a day. And you start burning your muscle, losing muscle, you start burning less calories. And it becomes one of these, that's with starvation. And with starvation, your body just eating itself up. And that's the miracle of HCG. It doesn't burn muscle, it burns fat.
Okay, well, let me try to define this. And stop me if I'm wrong, because you know, sure, I'm not a clinician, okay? The reason that HCG works is this. You get on a 500 calorie diet. Now,
right,
that's not a lot of calories.
Very few calories.
Yeah, you would think that because it's not a lot of calories, you know, your immune system wouldn't work, you wouldn't have the energy, and so on and so forth. But with the HCG, which from what I understand is a pregnancy hormone, what HCG does, it goes to the stored fat that's in your body. And it uses up the calories in the stored fat, which burns away the fat. So at the end of the day, you've taken in a minimal amount of calories, but at the same time, you're using your own body to sustain your health and your vigor, but that's going to offset what you're not getting in from your external take-in. Am I close here?
Perfectly said. And the question is, how does it do that, you know? And one of the latest theories, which I think is the best I've seen, is that leptin is a hormone that tells you that you're hungry or not hungry. When you have low leptin levels, you're hungry and you have to eat. And the more you eat, your leptin levels go up. And once you're satisfied, you don't eat anymore, you stop eating, you digest the food that you have in your system, your leptin levels drop, you know, and then you're hungry again. It seems that HCG keeps leptin levels high without requiring any caloric intake. And leptin is produced by all the fat cells in your body. And that also explains why on the HCG program, you start burning your fat, because that's where the leptin is being produced.
No, by the way,
yes.
Go ahead. Oh, I saw a very interesting statistic.
I had one more thought, and it's something I never really thought about. You kind of think that you're hungry, you eat, and that what you eat, that food readily becomes available for your energy to continue to keep your body going. It's actually a two-step process. You eat, you put food into your stomach. That food's being digested, but now your body is burning other calories, other energy, and then the food that you've just eaten, that gets moved into your fat stores and will be used at a later date. So you're not burning the same food for energy, so your intake and outtake, your input and output are different, even though they may balance itself. It's kind of like, I'll give you an example. If you earn $100 and you're looking at your total wealth, you earn $100 and you don't use that money right away to buy something, you write a check that the bank takes the money out of it, then you take the $100 that you've earned and put it back into the bank. So your net effect's the same. You make $100, you spend $100, but you're not spending the one you just put into your pocket.
I saw a very interesting statistic, and I think it was within the last 2 days, that 85% of the workforce out there is either overweight or obese. And the obesity is running just rampant in this country today, if not the world. And I'm looking at all the frustrations and all of the things that people are facing today, the challenges, et cetera, so on and so forth. And people are stuffing themselves so they don't have to feel that quote-unquote pain of living today?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure because, you know, we had a Great Depression 80 years ago. We've had world wars, you know, and so I'm not sure that's the answer. I don't know what the answer is, what the reason is. But I think that to think that we're more stressed today than we were 10 or 20 years ago, maybe yes, maybe no. We know the results. I think that's, we know what's going on. We're now trying to put a theory as to why it's going on. But what's so exciting, you know, we're also seeing an enormous increase in breast cancer. And I'm convinced that the majority of increase in breast cancer has come today because of the increase in obesity. And we know that that's clearly a risk factor. And the artificial hormones that women are taking, the birth control pill, the hormone replacement therapy. But I think that the obesity may be a bigger problem because that's what's been more out of control the last 25 years than ever before. And you could see almost a direct line between increase in breast cancer and, in fact, let me go better. Increase in breast cancer and prostate cancer almost directly related to increase in obesity.
Now, by the way,
it doesn't mean the tour. Yeah. Go ahead.
One of the ways you can lose weight today is shut your TV and your radio off.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's no question about that. But I think we're dealing now in a drastic time where we're not talking about losing 5 pounds or 10 pounds. That's what it was like 30, 40 years ago. People were 10 pounds overweight or 20 pounds overweight. You know, there was just an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago which said that the new look to the eye is about 25 pounds overweight. You know, which means that has an aesthetic look to us because so many of us are 25 pounds overweight. Yeah, that looks normal. They say the new overweight is looking normal to most people. And someone who's at a healthy weight looks undernourished to our eye. We're not talking about from a health standpoint, you know, and it's a serious problem, you know, and but I think we have an answer, you know. I mean, it just I really do think that the HCG, we've been so blessed now to take care of over 1,000 people, Michael, and over 90% are continuing to lose and have not put the weight back on, and some of them, like myself, is over 2 years now.
And by the way, it's keeping it off, I think, is really great. There are people who go through the bonding or the banding process, and they go through all of the operations in the world. And, you know, if they're not very careful, you know what happens? They end up with that weight back.
I don't even think it's careful because, you know, I have a patient of mine who I delivered two children for about 20 years ago. And I've had about 15 patients who've had surgical procedures, be it the lap band or the gastric bypass surgery. None of them have been, they put all the weight back on. And when I talk to them, they said that in their groups of 10 or 15 people who they get together with, every one of them has put the weight back on. The only difference is with the bypass surgery, the banding, it takes about 5 or 6 years before you start putting the weight back on. But the success rate is less than 10%. Now, when something is less than 10%, that tells me there's something wrong with the procedure. It's kind of like an exam in school. If only 10% of the students get the question right, that means there's either something wrong with the question or something wrong with the teacher. There's nothing. It's not possible that 90% did not get the question right. And in most standard exams, they'll throw that out. And she said to me something very interesting, that after about 5 or 6 years, you start developing an insatiable hunger. So I called some of the gastric bypass surgeons, and they said, it makes sense because you lose about 40% of your body muscle while you're doing the gastric bypass. And no matter how much you work out in the gym, you can't put the muscle back on, you know, because it's eating away at your muscle in the severe calorie restriction. And that's why, almost in a sense, it's doomed to failure, you know. And so it's a real problem, you know. This is the first thing I've seen personally as well in my practice, the HCG program, that has actually made a difference because as we measure the body composition, and we do that at every visit, it's running 70% fat loss and less than 10% muscle loss.
Wow. You know, when you really come down to it, and this also You've got to work with a doctor to do this. I think there's HCG out in the market that's over the counter, but I wonder what the legitimacy of the stuff is.
Well, it's legitimate, but it's not pharmaceutical HCG. It's homeopathic HCG. And there's some great, homeopathy is a wonderful branch of medicine, you know, but many of the things out there are not even homeopathic. They're just, you know, they have no HCG whatsoever, and they have a lot of minerals in them, you know, but nothing that really has been shown to make a big difference. I think that many of the people who have been successful on the over-the-counter HCGs, because they only have 10, 15, 20 pounds to lose. And there you could do a short-term, essentially, starvation. Now, or like you said, that's where you turn the TV off, you eat a little bit less, but you're not going to lose 80 pounds, 100 pounds, or 150 pounds doing something like that.
Mayor, I think when turning the television off wasn't necessarily when I said lose weight. It's the reason the stress is here more than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago is because of all of the messages, the mixed media messages.
To get
frightened. And you get frightened.
Oh, you're totally right.
Yeah, and unbelievable.
It's almost we have too much information.
Yeah.
A TMI, too much information, as my grandkids would say.
Yeah, I love it. Okay.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I definitely agree with you.
Okay, we're just about out of time. A website we can find you at and get product.
Yeah, homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. I'm going to look around for 1 second because I had a new video that I was putting up, and I'm not sure if it's up yet. I was in Atlanta this weekend speaking on the HCG program, and it's been I was there with about 100 doctors, and it's going to be up soon. Come to my website, go to the HCG. I'm not sure if it's up yet, but there's a new video there about what's going on.
Wonderful. Mayor, we'll see you next week. And again, one more time.
See you next week. Be well, my dear friend.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Bye. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And Mark Eisenhart back with us. He is the author of Get Empowered Now. He's an actor, a motivational speaker, an author, and a Reiki master, a vegan food advocate. And let's say, Mark, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Mark, let me ask you this. You know, we talk about getting empowered. You know, and empowered means so many different things to so many people. What, can we get a baseline definition of that word?
Well, boy, that's such a great question. I think, you know, one of the things that I talk about in my book is what I call Eisenhower's Law of Human Inertia, the first of which is that we're the only species on this planet that identifies the right thing to do and then makes a conscious choice not to do it, and that we tend to do what's familiar to us before we do what's best for us. So I'd say the baseline definition for that word, or what it means to me and what I talk about in my book, the intention that I'm building here for the various platforms that I'm extrapolating my story for, is to develop the skill set that worked for me and extrapolate that into a platform that can work for other people who want to make similar positive changes and transformations in their lives. You know, I believe that anybody can do what I did and have success with it. And what I'm committed to is for whatever's for my highest and greatest good, with no attachment to specific outcomes, and to use the skill set that worked for me to manifest that, to inspire and empower other people to do the same things for themselves. Because as we said in the conversation that we had following our radio interview, this is not really just about me. This is about everybody else seeing themselves in me and making similar changes in their lives.
Okay, where was it for you? Let's go back now. Where was it for you, this transition occurred for you, when the light bulb went on and you realized that the world wasn't the world you thought it was?
Well, you know, it actually started for me back in 1999 when I saw the movie The Matrix. That was sort of the spark that changed everything. But the catalyst for this whole thing to accelerate, for me to make a quantum leap and for the changes in my life to really take off, was after I watched my dad beat cancer to die of liver disease. He made his transition on the 7th of October of 2009, and on the 29th of November, I hit rock bottom, and my life had spiraled out of control. As I said on the previous show, I'd gotten up to 40 to 55 pounds and had 20 different things wrong with me, 20 different states of disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, anxiety, depression. So I was at rock bottom. There wasn't anything left for me to do. Fortunately, that's what it took for me to decide to get myself empowered and to make those kinds of changes in my life, because I wasn't living anymore. I was dead. I was going to say I was dying, but really I had died already. I'd stopped living.
Dude, I wonder how many people, Mark, that are walking around upright and dead. You know, people, they live their lives, they get up in the morning, they do whatever they do, and at the same time, they're not experiencing what life is about.
That's right. That's right. You know, I believe it's our God-given birthright to live abundant, prosperous, healthy, vital, and balanced lives. And, you know, I believe that's my intention, is that everybody be able to do that. And the key is balance. You know, we are here to experience life and its richness and its fullness. And I wasn't doing that anymore. I've gotten as far away from doing that as I possibly could. And so now that I am, you know, I'm committed to sharing my experience and the skill set that worked for me in a way that people can make similar changes in their life and live abundantly, live fully, live richly, live out loud, as I like to call it.
How easy, Mark, how easy is change? And when I say that, there are people who would love to turn their lives around, love to be able to experience life in a different way. How easy is change?
Well, I can only speak from my own experience, and it wasn't easy. It was a lot of hard work. You know, it required me to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and to remain comfortable with being uncomfortable for a long time, because that's where the growth happens. You know, and I have to have that willingness to sit and be still and be really okay with that. Change does not come easily. I can only speak from my experience. It didn't come easy for me. It was renewing and affirming that commitment that I made to myself every day. And really being willing to endure all of the things that came with it. And at times it was not fun and it was not easy. At times it was downright, you know, the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. I can remember times when I would go in and talk to the people that I was working with, and I said, I feel horrible today. This is terrible. I don't like this at all. And they said, congratulations, you're doing it right. You know?
No, absolutely, because I think the worse the challenge, the tougher it is, the bigger the pain, quote unquote, when you get through it and then you get to look back, you realize the absolute strength in it. And there's truly strength in it. It's the adversities. It's the challenges. It's those times in our life when we think, you know, it's over with. It's not good. And I would venture to guess that the book and all of the things that you're doing is also a legacy for your father. because that's when it started. That's when it kicked in and you went through what you went through to get it all, get it, not even so much get it back together, get it started. So in essence, there'll be a lot of good things that'll come out of it, and the gifts that'll, 100 years from now, when somebody reads the book and they get something out of it, you won't be around, but at the same time, you've added to somebody's strength, somebody's life.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I'm glad you touched upon that, because one of the things that I included in my spiritual practice was whenever I felt like I was doing something that was difficult or painful for me, or difficult for me to maintain, I would do something that was more difficult, and then that gave me perspective on it. And that's an incredible way to reprogram your subconscious mind and to train your subconscious mind. As an example, you know, I would go into continuous states of meditation and prayer for weeks and months at a time. And there were times when I got really tired of sitting meditation. You know, my body was aching, my back was aching, something like that. So one of the things that I did to challenge myself and to really step up my game and affirm that commitment I made to myself was I would do squatting meditations. If you can imagine what that would feel like, meditation for somebody who's not used to it or just getting started, in and of itself is very difficult to do, to really train the mind to exist in the emptiness between thoughts and to be still. So if you can imagine then doing a squatting meditation, there were times where my legs were on fire. I felt like I was absolutely going to collapse. And I was focusing on the emptiness and that stillness in the breath instead of the fact that it felt like my legs were absolutely on fire and they were going to explode. But being able to do that, being able to discipline myself like that has really made all the difference in the world, and that's a skill that I have continue to use in my daily life and other aspects of it. If I'm doing something difficult, I do something that's even more difficult, and then I go back to whatever it was I was doing before, and it seems like a cakewalk to me.
You know, when you talk about
aspects of our life.
Somewhere, don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk. I'm Dresser at the Dark.
This is good.
And
we can
Mark Eisenhart back with us.
Mark, we're doing your
now.
Show over again.
He's an actor, a motivational speaker, an author, and a Reiki master, a vegan food advocate. And let's say, Mark, hi, welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm so grateful to be here.
Hey, this is good, Mark. You can actually hear the show. You're doing it. I have a year-old cat that jumped all over the equipment, so that's what happened. But we got most of it.
Okay.
Now, when we really come down to it, and when you look at the word change, change is so different for so many people, and you've gone through it to an extreme that most people won't. But there have got to be people that have picked up the book, and they saw what you did, and they got something out of that book that turned their life around. Have you had anybody feed you back with this now?
Yeah, I really have, and it's been wonderful to get that feedback. It's been really encouraging and inspiring for me to know that not only is it getting to people, but that to get positive feedback. You know, I got some feedback just recently on my Facebook wall that said, you know, this changed my life, this book changed my life. And I was blown away the other day, a couple of days ago. You know, the Internet makes things so accessible. I actually got an email from a person who owns a sportswear company and was interested in possibly a sponsorship or partnership, business partnership, all the way in China. And I was just blown away by that. And the Internet makes everybody so accessible. So my intention is to go global with this, my experience and my story. And there was just a nice affirmation to know that I got all the way to China, to someone I would have, you know, never been able to reach, you know, in Portland, Oregon. Limited by the scope of my, you know, regular networking on a day-to-day basis. So it was nice to get that feedback from somebody.
But what's your end result for this? You know, when it's all done and over with, it'll never be done and over with, but when you've got what you think you want, what's the end result for you? What's the final goal?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I think, you know, for me, it keeps changing. I keep recreating and reinventing myself, but my intention is to take the story, you know, definitely I've got a commitment from a local filmmaker to adapt it for film and to submit that to the Sundance Film Festival, because I believe the story is best portrayed on the big screen. And then to use that experience and the revenue that comes from that and the resources that come from that in a global speaking platform to share my experience and my skill set with people in a live setting that's organic and spontaneous. There's just nothing like that. And then I would like to, I'll be frank, I would like to go into politics. I wouldn't like to go into politics officially, but I believe that I am the change that I want to see in the world, and I want to go onto a platform that empowers me to make and manifest those kinds of changes. You know, I envision a world, I call it the world the way it should be all the time, a world that's free of racism and discrimination and war and violence and poverty. I envision a world where everybody has access to high vibrational foods, organic foods, plant strong foods. You know, I'm proof that changing what you eat changes who you are. And I look forward to the day where we do things because it's the right thing to do, and we all come from a place of unconditional love and compassion and gratitude in relationship to whatever happens. I realize that to some people that might seem like a lofty goal or an unrealistic goal, but I don't believe it is. You know, one of the things we talked about in the last interview is that from nothingness comes everything. You know, from going inside yourself and finding that emptiness comes fullness and richness. And I believe everything is possible. I believe we all have the ability to break those laws of inertia that I spoke about, you know, doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And I believe the world is moving in that direction and could be a better place. And so my intention is to contribute to that energy and that momentum, positivity, and about being the change that I want to see in the world. So that may seem like a big, big end game for people, but I don't think it's an unrealistic goal. Some might call me, you know, quixotic or idealist to the point of the absurd, but I don't think it is. I think it's possible to do that.
But it's a trickle-up effect, not a trickle-down, but it's a trickle-up effect. And the importance about nothingness is when you come from a place of nothing, there's nothing there, so you get to create. But if you come from a place where there's something there, all you're doing is expanding on the old stuff, which gets you in trouble in the first place. So coming from a place of complete creativity, and I believe that the planet's still got a chance, but again, it's got to trickle up. It's got to come from the people. It's not going to come from those who are in power, who have some kind of an agenda, whether it be money, whether it be something, power, whatever it is that drives them at that particular moment. So if the consciousness is strong enough, you look at what happened in a couple of the Middle Eastern countries so far. So you can see things change. I don't necessarily like the way they politically took over, but at the same time, if you want something, you can get it.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. I envision some version of co-creating a hub on all seven continents where a bunch of people of like mind sit around at a room, in a room, at a table, in a circle as equals, and create solutions to all the problems that we're facing globally. I believe that's possible. I believe to some extent that's happening now, obviously, in various, you know, aspects of the private sector, and so I want to eventually contribute to that. I'm a person that is proof that just keeping your eyes and your energy and your momentum and your focus on the solution creates all kinds of wonderful and positive things. So I see that as being, you know, where I eventually end up going in some official capacity involved in the private sector and politics.
Yeah, but you've got to have a definition of the solution. And the reason I say that is if you go down to Wall Street right now and you see all those kids doing whatever they're doing, everybody's got a different reason, everybody's got a different answer, and everybody's got a different quote-unquote solution, and they're all not on the same page. What has to happen, if there's going to be solution, it's got to be a recognizable solution for everybody and everybody moving in the same direction. Mark, we're about out of time. Website we can find you at and buy the book.
My website is www.getempowerednow.com. Empowered is spelled with an I, like impulse power. Thanks so much for having me. Thanks to my mom, my dad, my sister, and thehealthforce.com and all my sponsors. I'm so glad to be here. It's great to talk to you again.
Wonderful. Hey, Mark, take care. Good night.
All right, thanks. All right, bye-bye.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is
a wrap.
We're parting out as friends. cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do.